Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A state agency keeps bleeding red ink, and Florida lawmakers will have to deal with it somehow.
The state plan says you have to stay within appropriation. The federal government says, regardless of your appropriation, you have to fund these people. So what do you do? That's why we are where we are.
Also this week, breaking news, federal indictments by the bushel involving stolen emergency funds implicating dozens of people, including some Florida elected officials.
Carlson then, in turn, received cash kickbacks from the Carlson conspirators with the illegal taxpayer funds that were the substance of the proceeds.
We'll also hear about a new outbreak of red tide and then head to the Everglades to track down ever-elusive and invasive pythons. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. In the upcoming months, Florida state lawmakers will grapple with a decision, how to stabilize the budget of one of the state's health care agencies. The Agency for Persons with Disabilities has run deficits in most years since it was created in the early 2000s. Lawmakers have become increasingly frustrated about constantly having to backfill those deficits, but Lynn Hatter reports advocates are concerned over which chamber will get final say over how the agency moves forward.
When Hurricane Michael struck North Florida last year, it devastated parts of the panhandle and left tens of thousands of people homeless, powerless, and waterless. Amanda Baker is one of them. After Michael, she came to Tallahassee from Panama City.
Because I was critically ill at that time, I had been without electricity and water for 7 days.
Baker uses a wheelchair, and she relies on caregivers to help her throughout the day.
So I have to have personal care every day, and they have to come in and help me bathe and help me get dressed, fix my food.
That help is funded through Medicaid. The money is sorted out by the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. Baker and nearly 35,000 other Floridians depend on that funding to keep them out of institutions and in their own homes and communities. But the agency has consistently overspent its budget due to state underfunding and federal program requirements. Agency Secretary Barbara Palmer says APD is in a catch-22.
The state plan says you have to stay within appropriation. The federal government says, regardless of your appropriation, you have to fund these people. So what do? You know, that's why we are where we are.
There are about 21,000 people on a waiting list for services, and those services are for life. Tallahassee's Amanda Baker has had her services since she was 3. Today, she's 39 and vice president of the Florida Developmental Disabilities Council. It advises the governor and legislature on policy, and it has some advice of its own. In order to get costs under control, the legislature should move APD into its Social Services Estimating Committee to, well, estimate future costs.
We believe that this would be helpful in realistic expectations and expenditure amounts.
APD Secretary Barbara Palmer says there are also problems with how funding is doled out.
But what happens in the algorithm is this. We're given a certain amount of money, and then we run everybody through that algorithm, and out the other side comes, this is the amount that you get. What we found is it's not always what you need, it's what you get.
Florida lawmakers ordered the Agency for Healthcare Administration and APD to come up with a list of recommendations to contain costs. The agencies submitted their list in September. Bottom line, give APD more money. Florida is last in the nation when it comes to funding for disability services. Yet, what may be more important is what's not included in their recommendations, privatizing the program.
But I understand that this redesign request came from the House, and it was specifically to be looking at managed care. And I know that the House has been looking at it. The Senate has been very helpful in not having that happen over the years. We want to keep that from happening.
Vin Sequienzia is president emeritus of the Autism Society of Florida. The state has privatized most of its Medicaid program, shifting people to managed care and letting private healthcare companies administer it. ACA oversees most of the system with the exception of the people served by APD. The Florida House has expressed interest in using managed care with people with developmental disabilities, a move that alarms disability rights advocates who say those private insurers aren't able to handle the type of caregiving and independent living services disabled Floridians rely on. And during a recent presentation to reporters, Governor Ron DeSantis was asked about the APD's funding future.
I think it's been a tough issue fiscally, but I think it's an issue where, you know, some of these folks are in pretty bad shape, and we have a responsibility to do what we can. So I'm very open about the best way forward. I'm not saying one or the other.
The worry? If the House gets its way, people will likely lose services, not gain them. I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
Here's a story that just broke this afternoon. 29 people in the panhandle were indicted today for profiting from a federal drought assistance program. WFSU's Valerie Crowder reports the alleged criminal network included 9 government employees.
Federal prosecutors say Dwayne Crossan led a conspiracy in 2017 to steal more than $373,000 from a taxpayer-funded drought assistance program. Crossan is the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Farm Service Agency Director for Bay, Holmes, and Washington counties. Assistant U.S. Attorney Jason Coody says Crossan and some of his co-conspirators submitted assistance claims for property they did not own or lease.
As a result, those government payments were then deposited into the respective bank accounts of the identified co-conspirators, and Crossan then, in turn, received cash kickbacks from the Crossan conspirators with the illegal taxpayer funds that were the substance of the proceeds.
Each defendant listed in the indictment could face up to 20 years in prison for conspiracy to commit wire fraud and up to 10 years for theft of government funds. Prosecutors say the investigation is still ongoing. I'm Valerie Crowder in Panama City.
Florida's jobless rate remained at the 3.2% level in October, the same as it was in September. One number that went up for the month was labor force participation. It increased for the third consecutive month. Also, private sector businesses created over 22,000 new jobs in October. Florida's annual private sector growth rate of 2.8% continues to outpace the national job growth rate, which sits at 1.5%. Today, Governor Ron DeSantis announced the appointment of Randall Hunt as Secretary of the Florida Lottery. The appointment comes following the resignation of former Florida Lottery Secretary Jim Papel. Hunt of Lake Mary is the owner and chief executive officer of Athletic Apex, a national health and fitness chain. He was appointed as a board member of the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority by the governor back in February. After years of rejecting Medicaid expansion in the state capitol, the Florida House and Senate are trying to block a proposed constitutional amendment that would put the issue before voters. The House and Senate late this week filed briefs at the Florida Supreme Court, raising a series of legal objections to a proposed ballot initiative that would require expansion of Medicaid to cover more low-income adults. The briefs argue in part that the proposal would be misleading to voters and improperly infringe on the legislature's powers. For example, the briefs contend the proposed amendment would have broader effects than expanding Medicaid to more people. They argue it would effectively force the legislature to take part in the broader Medicaid program, which is optional for states. Still to come on Capitol Report, the 2016 presidential election boiled down to the Electoral College ballots trumping the popular election ballots. Now there's a possible solution to any future conflicts like that.
What if we all agreed that the person who wins the nationwide vote should be president?
Last year, red tide outbreaks were the scourge of several Florida coastal communities. They're back.
And one of the underlying questions here is, can the neurotoxins create inflammation in the brain? Let's hope that they can't.
And we all know that pythons in the Florida wilds are tough to find. But it also turns out these invasive alpha predator reptiles may be nearly indestructible too.
I had University of Florida bring me a python once that had been frozen for 2 weeks. And when we thawed it out to do the necropsy, the heart started beating again.
A proposed interstate agreement that would create a true popular vote election is moving across the nation. This week, one of the plan's original authors talked with state lawmakers during a lunch and learn event. Ryan Daly heard from Vic Amar about the idea he hatched nearly two decades ago.
Could states decide to give their electors not to the candidate who won the most votes in that state, but to the person who won the most votes nationwide? Because the Constitution gives states total control over how to pick their electors.
Vic Amar is dean of the University of Illinois College of Law and has been a professor of constitutional law for years. About 18 years ago, Amar and his brother came up with an idea they thought might have a shot at changing a system Amar sees as flawed.
In both 2000 and 2016, but four times earlier in American history as well, you had a president who won the so-called Electoral College, but who got fewer votes in terms of the popular vote than his opponent.
Amar and proponents of a national popular vote say the Electoral College system puts more weight behind voters in states with smaller populations.
That rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, because what it means is that votes aren't being counted equally throughout the whole country.
And Amar adds, it's not just the way votes are counted that is influenced by the system in place, it's also the way candidates campaign.
With the system currently in place, we know that presidential elections don't really get waged in a lot of states. They get waged only in a few swing states. So places like Texas are completely ignored. Places like Alabama are completely ignored, because they are going to go Republican no matter what. So too, places like California are ignored, because it doesn't matter if you win California by a wide margin or by a small margin.
So what could be done to change the system without having to amend the U.S. Constitution?
States may not want to unilaterally move in this direction. So what we proposed, my brother and I, who's also a law professor, is that states enter into a coordinated agreement where they say, we will give our electors to the nationwide winner, regardless of who wins in our state, provided there are enough other states who have agreed to do so to get more than half of the Electoral College on board.
Getting a majority of the Electoral College would mean enough states to equal 270 electors. Florida, the third largest state in the nation, carries 29. Already, 15 states and Washington, D.C. have passed legislation adopting the agreement, totaling 196 electors. In the hypothetical that all states agreed to the compact, Amar thinks some election reforms would be in order.
One of the things that I think should be done, that would be need to be done, after enough states sign on to this, but before it goes into effect, is there should be some standardization of the balloting process and the counting process so that we can get a reliable national tally.
And that kind of overhaul would take time. For that reason and others, Amar wants his plan to have a delayed implementation.
That might take a little while, which is why I've advocated for states to adopt this idea, but defer implementation until, say, 2032. So Florida would adopt it today, but say, our adoption takes effect when you get to 270, but no earlier than 2032. That would both give Congress time in the meanwhile to iron out any logistical wrinkles of the kind that you just mentioned, and it would also diffuse the wrongheaded but persistent assumption that some people have that this is going to help one political party or hurt the other. If you defer implementation until, say, 12 years from now, there's no way anyone could really predict who it's going to help or hurt, and that underscores that this is a statement of principle, not partisanship.
Bills filed in the Florida legislature for the upcoming session to join the interstate agreement are sponsored by Democratic Senator Victor Torres and Representative Joe Geller. Geller, Torres, and about seven other lawmakers were on hand for the lunch and learn session with Amar. All but one of those were Democrats, with Representative Sam Killebrew attending as the lone Republican. Geller says his backing of the plan doesn't come from a place of partisanship.
I'm not for this because I think it helps Democrats. I'm for this because I think it helps democracy, and it's about one person, one vote, which should be our guideline. If this system was not in the Constitution, it would be unconstitutional.
Geller's bill is waiting to be heard by the House Oversight, Transparency, and Public Management Subcommittee. I'm Ryan Daly.
Toxic red tide algae is starting to bloom along Florida's west coast again. State wildlife officials say elevated levels have been detected recently from Pinellas to Collier counties, and people in Sarasota County have been experiencing respiratory irritations. Health News Florida's Jessica Mazaros reports on new research looking into long-term health effects of the toxins, including neurological issues.
Clear waves foam up and roll onto the white sand of Siesta Key Beach. On this sunny October day, people are swimming, tanning, and jogging. Not a sight seen this time last year, when people were coughing, eyes watering, and dead fish were stinking for miles. Barbara Kirkpatrick lives just down the road. She's a scientist who's been studying red tide and how it affects people for two decades. A study she led back in 2001 examined asthma patients over a span of 10 years.
The aerosolized red tide toxin is a trigger for their asthma. And after just a 1 hour walk on the beach during a red tide, people had symptoms for 3 to 5 days after that 1 hour walk on the beach.
One of her patients was Allison Peterson, who at the time lived near Bradenton, about 7 miles inland. Peterson now lives in South Carolina. She spoke to us from her office.
My running partner and I, we would choose running paths along the beach and the water. There was a really nice overpass that went over the bay that we always did, and I started noticing that other than the exercise-induced asthma that I had, that it would get worse.
Peterson says a regular asthma attack feels like a fist wrapping around her lungs, making it hard to breathe.
When I'd have issues from the red tide, it would be more of like a burning, tingling sensation. When I'd take a breath, it didn't feel good, and that in turn would kind of cause the wheezing and make it a little harder to catch my breath.
She would also get headaches, but since moving north, she says she's very rarely had any issues. Peterson says she's curious about the long-term health effects of algae toxins she's been exposed to. Roskamp Institute in Sarasota is studying just that. It's collecting blood and urine samples after some patients also reported headaches and other symptoms during the last red tide event. Dr. Michael Mullen is executive director of Roskamp.
And one of the underlying questions here is, can the neurotoxins create inflammation in the brain? Let's hope that they can't, but if they can, we need to know about that.
So Roskamp is building a bank of people's fluids before and after red tide events that it hopes to share with other researchers.
Remarkably, there are really no long-term exposure data or effects of exposure collected anywhere. And this is the beginning, I hope, of a more substantial database and a biobank in that regard. It really needs to be done.
Mullen joined researchers from Moat Marine Laboratory and Sarasota Memorial Hospital at a press conference this summer, where Congressman Vern Buchanan of Sarasota announced a proposal to fund human health research like this, over $6 million. Barb Kirkpatrick, the scientist we met back on the beach, says she's working with Roskamp Institute on its new database, using one of her old studies.
So we actually reran the data looking specifically at headache as a diagnosis code. And indeed, it was identified, and especially in the older population, which of course we have here in our area.
Kirkpatrick is on the State Harmful Algal Bloom Task Force, which first met in St. Petersburg this past September. The group discussed funding for this issue of chronic exposure to red tide. Kirkpatrick hopes they can identify science gaps that have not yet been funded.
It has been a roller coaster. We usually see an uptick of funding when we've had a red tide. And then if we go for a year, or maybe we get lucky and go a couple years with no red tide, guess what? The funding disappears.
Now, as red tide creeps back up the West Coast, it's an ideal time to secure funding that could lead to a breakthrough in human health research. For Health News Florida, I'm Jessica Mazaros on Siesta Key Beach.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, since the first one was captured in Everglades National Park 40 years ago last month, Burmese pythons have spread across Florida, becoming the most voracious predator in the wild and upending the ecosystem. State contracted hunters have bagged at least 3,500, but nearly all of those have been on roads and levees, not out in the wild where the snakes are doing the most damage. A team of U.S. Geological Survey and National Park Service biologists are now trying to find a better way to track and trap the snakes. WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich went with them.
So I won't make you guys mask up as long as...
Frank Ridgely is a veterinarian at Zoo Miami. He's standing in the zoo surgical suite. It's got a concrete floor that's easy to hose down and trays loaded with scalpels and surgical instruments. Since he's been at the zoo, Ridgely's implanted radio trackers into about 50 pythons.
So Matt's going to try to keep it mostly in the bag and just get the head out, and we'll see how happy this snake is.
The 7.5-foot snake was captured at the Big Cypress National Preserve. Matt McAllister is a biologist there. He drove the python over in a locked box this morning after scientists decided the snake would make an ideal candidate for a behavioral study on pythons. The study is basically trying to figure out how to build a better snake trap by observing the habits of pythons. To do that, Ridgely will need to implant a fist-sized transmitter and battery in the snake, then thread a foot-long antenna down its side between the ribs and skin.
So are you comfortable intubating Rosemary?
Once Ridgely and vet tech Rosemary Lucas get the snake knocked out, they attach an ultrasound to monitor its heart, the same kind doctors use on pregnant women. Ridgely works quickly, slicing between the python's scales to open up its body cavity.
You gotta have a nice sharp scalpel to get in between there. I like the Doppler noise. It's like my comfort noise during surgery, right? That does not necessarily mean the snake is alive still, though. I had University of Florida bring me a python once that had been frozen for 2 weeks. And when we thawed it out to do the necropsy, the heart started beating again.
Before he inserts the transmitter, Ridgely asked McAllister to do a quick test to make sure it works.
You already got the frequency?
Yeah.
This is step one. And it turns out, at least for the humans involved, it's the easy part of the project.
The brakes are pretty sticky on this machine, so if I stop, it'll
Matt McAllister, he's the big cypress biologist, is at the wheel of the swamp buggy we jump into near the Monument Lake campground at the preserve. It's sort of like a tractor on big fat tires that can take bumps and won't sink into the sand. Jill Josimovich and Andrea Currilow are with him. Josimovich is in charge of the study. She's a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Currilow is a biologist there too. And today, we're looking for snake C5, or Charlie. Josimovich has coordinates from an aerial flight yesterday that give her a general idea of where Charlie might be. So we head down the trail for the beginning of a grueling day of python tracking.
What do you see?
There's a lion track.
Oh, really?
The lion track is from a rare Florida panther. It takes about an hour to reach the end of the trail where we hop out. Josimovich gets to work attaching an antenna, like you'd see on an old TV, to the receiver.
Are those locusts or cicadas or the... I love that sound.
For the last year, Josimovich and McAllister and a team of scientists have been tracking more than 20 snakes here and in Everglades National Park using the transmitters implanted at Zoo Miami. They're watching when and where the snakes move to get an idea of what kinds of conditions pythons like. That kind of information can be used to help hunters. They only have about a 1% chance of spotting snakes. The biologists are also using the trackers to follow Judas snakes. That's when a snake is used to lead scientists to other snakes, especially during the breeding season when a half dozen males can ball up with a single female. But first, they have to find Charlie.
Sometimes he is in places that are very easy to walk to. And other times they're in, you know, hardwood hammocks or habitats that are just a lot more challenging.
I mean, it's no wonder that you could never find a snake in this without...
Oh, right, right. It's
you can't see
virtually
your own
feet. Impossible, yep. So let me see if I can let you hear here. So if you can pick up that beeping sound, that'll tell us where the snake is. So now we're going to go on a game of hide and seek.
We follow the transmitter down the trail, then jump off into ferns as high as your head, then back onto the trail, pocked with holes and covered in water. This is clearly not a place for amateurs.
Nice. Oh!
That's me falling into a hole in the trail. Once I dry off my dignity, we follow the beeps until the trail dead ends at a hunting camp. It's one of the few that were grandfathered in when the swamp was turned into a national preserve. We work our way around the camp, in and out of the swamp. A cathedral of cypress and water up to our waist brings some relief from the 90-degree heat.
Back in the ferns.
We bushwhack our way further in. For about an hour, we fight wasps and stumble over downed trees hidden in the dense brush. Then, Josimovich stops.
I see him. You see him?
Yeah.
Amazing.
What we see through the ferns is about a 2-inch square patch of patterned scales on a 10-foot snake. It's Charlie, just a couple of feet away, disappearing silently into the ferns.
Oh, thanks. Oh, cool. So he's
wow, gone. I saw my first wild.
Now that they found him, Josimovich and Curilo measure wind speed and temperatures and jot down other conditions. As hard as it was to get here, it only takes 5 minutes to collect the data. We head back, but when we get near the camp, Matt spots a mound sticking out of the swamp.
That's all alligator eggshell.
An alligator nest. McAllister thinks it's empty at first.
Oh, there's the baby gators. There's like 50.
So just be careful. She ought to be pretty close.
Yeah.
McAllister says the mom is probably close by. This time, we ignore the no trespassing signs around the hunting camp and cut through it to avoid the baby gator's mom. Josimovich uses her GPS to find the buggy, and we head out quickly. So this is what it takes to find a python, just one of the estimated thousands. Josimovich and McAllister concede it is probably too late for Florida to rid itself of all these pythons screwing up the food chain and reshaping the ecosystem. But they're optimistic that they can do a better job managing the snakes in the wild. In the months ahead, they'll be back again and again, trying to figure out how to trap a python out here with the gators and armed hunt camps and ferns so thick you can be standing on top of a 10-foot snake and barely see it. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in the Big Cypress National Preserve.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Jessica Mazaros and Jenny Stiletovich. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.